Congress to have rights of the degree that they did. I think maybe if you took a vote in Alaska today, and the price of the native settlement had to be paid entirely by Alaskans, you would find that there is still not a very wide acceptance of the settlement that was accepted by Congress. It's easy enough for Alaskans to say, well, great, you know, if it's going to be paid for by Uncle Sam, and if it's going to clear the way for oil exploration and the building of a pipeline, which so many people wanted. But I'm ashamed in a way that we didn't give more thought to this, but it just wasn't a burning issue.
George, just as a matter of information, my reading of that history is inadequate. What were the politics of the campaigns to run for membership at the convention like? Was it, generally speaking, a hotly contested thing, people to run? Was there high interest in winning those seats?
I would say yes.
I would say no.
Sort of the thing, you know, there were a lot of people, I think we all tried to outdo ourselves in saying how strong we were for statehood was sort of the main issue. And most of the people who were elected delegates were strong statehood advocates. And we saw this as an instrument and a vehicle to help us achieve statehood. As in most elections, I think the contests were largely a popularity contest. And I don't think it was fought out at all on the basis of issues, if that's what you're asking. I don't think that anybody ever got up there and said, I'm going to be for this kind of a natural resources article, and his opponent said, no, I'm for a different kind. That kind of discussion just didn't come up, as far as I observed it, in the electioneering.
Comment just a minute on that. I have a little different conception than George. George ran for the statewide office, and so his was more of a campaign than most of us who were elected from what I call rural areas. Some people call it bush. Many places had trouble finding somebody to actually go out and get the 25 signatures or whatever it was to get on the ballot. And there just was not any great deal of interest out in the bush. The native people at that time really hadn't realized how bad off they were, if that's the way you're going to put it, I guess. They knew they had these rights, but these rights were recognized by both their leaders and by the Constitutional Convention delegates as an obligation of the United States of America, not of the state of Alaska. In fact, the state of Alaska and the Element Settlement, or that led to the Settlement Act passing, the state of Alaska certainly gave a great deal more, which I'm glad they did, gave a great deal more than they had to do, they had a legal responsibility to do. But I think that the comment it is again a question of the time era. If this were to happen now, there would be a tremendous concern and a tremendous overall thinking in relationship to the subsistence question and to the and also to the cultural program. I think there'd be more of that, and there'd certainly be more in the environmental and conservation. But I don't think it would change the wording so much. I mean, the parameters so much. It would simply give that different direction and recognition of the things that were going on. I'd like to read just in relation to this, just one little item. Now I'm quoting from a gentleman that gave a delegate that was giving a speech on the floor. Many people, Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts, have been born, lived, and died waiting for the blessing of the great white father to settle on them under the Aboriginal rights, and they have not been treated right. They have missed their blessing, and the time has come for the great white father to settle down on these people what he has promised them. We can make this Constitution with heart and soul and justice in it if we just do that little thing and not forever pass by these people who are pleading to us. I believe this convention has the honor and the justice and the will to do the job which the United States government has been unable to do. And that was Mr. Delegate Marston speaking on behalf of the allocation of state lands to the native people of Alaska. So it wasn't that nobody talked about
them. I think, well, go ahead, then Claus and ask you.
Ada Wien again would like to answer that last question, and I have seldom disagreed with George Thunberg, but I do now. And I think perhaps his answer came as a man who had been working for statehood and in Juneau, but in Fairbanks. I want to tell you some of my personal experiences to show you how uninformed Alaskans were. I was the first one in the Fairbanks district to file, and afterwards, a member of the staff of the University of Alaska asked my daughter, who else I should vote for. Another person who had signed my petition met me on the street, and she said, did you get elected to whatever it was I signed? I don't know what I signed for. There just simply was not that interest or that knowledge among the people, at least around Fairbanks. And I want to tell you why I ran. I think this is rather interesting, possibly to all of you, why I happened to run for the Constitution. I was in a Toastmasters club and ultimately wound up as president. We'd had two excellent years, and most of the women in it had been professional women from different endeavors in Alaska. And although Vic Fisher listed me as a housewife, I never considered that I had been married to a house. I married a man and was involved. And was involved in many endeavors, not only in the airline work, but always for the good of Alaska. But I sort of lost my thought there since you laughed at me. But in being president of the Toastmasters Club, Dr. Moberg of the University of Alaska prepared 10 packets on statehood, which the packets comprised three large volumes that had been prepared for the University of Hawaii Constitution and other constitutions, including the Constitution of the United States, for comparison. So I took this up at the Toastmasters Club, and not knowing myself really how I felt totally about statehood, I suggested that we take out one of the packets. He prepared these, and it was a piece in the Newsminer that said any club could take them out. There were 10 packets. So I asked the Toastmasters Club if they wouldn't be interested in our taking this packet out and for me to appoint a debating team with three for and three against, and discussing statehood in a method of education. Toastmasters, if you're familiar with it, or Toastmasters, you can discuss any subject, political, religious, but never take a stand on it. And I suggested we not take a vote, but use it for educational purposes. Someone moved that we appoint a committee to study the situation. They came back at the next meeting and turned it down because it was too political. I was shocked, totally shocked, and somewhat disgusted. I finished my term and continued a little while in Toastmasters because they were beginning to celebrate people's birthdays and doing the usual woman social thing. So I called Dr. Moberg, and I asked him how many packets had been taken out. And he said, Ada, you won't believe it, but only three, two by labor unions and one by the Moose Lodge. And he said, why don't you take the packet out? So I took it. I had raised my family, and one day my daughter was married, and the next day my son left for the States in the service. And I had a 17-year-old son home who didn't want to stay home too much, and I asked him why, and he said, well, I've never known home without my brother and sister, and it's not very interesting anymore. So I was a mother left with this empty nest. So I took the packet home and studied it, made that my project, and studied it for a year. Now, I'm not telling you this to give you my background, but to give you an example of the feeling of the people in Alaska then and how they didn't know, the general populace didn't know and didn't care. And today you are more aware. And I just hope that, again, I will say, you men of the now and the future, we'll try to work together and keep environment and industry in balance and work together.
Well, 55 people cared enough to write a constitution anyway, so. Claus, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, my name is Claus Nasky. I just want to add a few things to what George Sundberg said, and I think that we tend to forget very often that Brown versus Board of Education didn't come until 1954. And that in 1955, 56, when the Constitution was written, native rights really were not a major concern of most Alaskans. Although, if you go back and study the statehood bills, Tony Diamond introduced one in 1943, and Langer and McCarran in the spring of the same year. And you will find that the first statehood bills were very traditional, following the ones from Oklahoma and Arizona and New Mexico and so on. And that the Bartlett Bill in 1945, the first one he introduced, did not contain any safeguards as far as native rights were concerned. And that I think it was 1946 that Mr. Curry and various other lawyers with the Indian Rights Organization in New York became very interested or looked out for native concerns, not only in Alaska but in the continental United States as well, and insisted to various congressional committees that statehood bills of any form or shape were unacceptable unless there was a disclaimer clause included. And from 1946 onward, all statehood bills had disclaimer clauses that recognized some nebulous rights that natives possessed, but that the resolution of these rights should be left up to the courts. It was not Congress at that point, that it should be either Congress or the courts should resolve these claims. And of course, it seems to me that the black struggle in the 1960s, the oil exploration and the conservation movement that all happened to coincide or come together at this particular point made possible the Native Claims Settlement Act. But as far as my reading of the history of that particular period is concerned, Alaskans were not aware or not concerned with Native rights at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Claus, for setting the historical record straight. I know for myself what I really wanted more than anything else was to be out from under federal fish and game regulation. You know, I was just tired of having the moose season open for the same number of days every year, no matter how many moose there were, and having the same beaver limit every year, no matter how many beaver there were. That was what irritated me more than just about anything about the federal structure. One last chance for anyone else?
One more thing. There were 187 people who manned before the 5 spots, so there was rather widespread interest.
You'll also find, though, that the majority of the competition was in the urban areas.
Yeah, one of the cases was an insult.
Well, that's because they were stirred up because you were a candidate. Right.
Well, I think, from the perception of the chair, that we have found that all in all, at least far as administration in major areas, with the possible exception of the commercial fisheries, that we have a workable document still. At least I didn't hear anyone state that there were anything in the document that may put unnecessary impositions into the application of good resources policy by the legislature or the executive. I did detect that there was a desire on many people's part that the Constitution, not particularly Article 8, but possibly the Constitution in general, could have a little more uniquely Alaskan flavor, and we certainly discussed that thoroughly. The point that was brought up on the federal programs which impact Alaska, and in those why we would have to count also the Claims Settlement Act, since it was a congressional act, and also of course the Statehood Act itself is a congressional act. But as these affect us, why there are no easy answers. Rewriting the Constitution, nobody pointed out that there were any barriers in the existing Constitution to the kind of cooperative structures which will be necessary to work things out with these overwhelming federal programs. Subsistence is an issue that maybe have to be wrestled with constitutionally, and it's going to be a very difficult one to wrestle with, however we come out. And I hope that the discussion on subsistence can be carried on. within a constitutional framework which imposes certain limits to what could otherwise become a very acrimonious debate. And points that were brought up on transportation corridors, there is a good deal of work going on right now, and the Constitution itself seems to do an adequate job on easements on state lands for state purposes, which is what we are concerned with here now. The easements for state purposes across federal lands, that problem will be taken up with the Congress in the considerations of the national interest lands as those bills come before the Congress. So we look at the shape of a future regarding our lands and resources, where we have 103 million acres of state land ultimately, to at least to what the state entitlement is necessary to. I'm not trying to commit you to anything, Guy. 44 million acres of native land, more or less, and remaining 228 million acres of federal land. I think it's important to remember that what we're talking about on that federal land is a mix of managers for it, and what the relationship of the state government and the people of the state is going to be to those managers. And also, I didn't detect from the conversations today, once again, that the Constitution was any particular barrier to those relationships. And there are many other things which we'll cover in the summary tomorrow, but those are the main points I got out of today's discussions, and I think some very good points were made by Bob Wheat and Dave Morton and others on possible wording changes, but also the equal point was made that the flexibility is there within these articles to develop policy the way you want it. And in my training, why constitutions are supposed to be flexible documents that establish broad guidelines that guarantee certain inviolable rights of citizens, which, and of course that is contained largely in Article 1. And I don't think in, of course, that was handled in other sessions today, so I won't particularly speak to that. But at least from our perception here today, there are not major flaws with the Constitution as an instrument of government. Some people still have some very basic problems with some of the philosophical expressions which it makes, and that debate will probably continue. Thank you for coming. I want to especially thank the delegates who were here and contributed so much.